When was the last time you saw a primary care provider? 1 in 5 U.S. residents has no usual source of health care, and that means they usually end up in the emergency department. What are the policy solutions for fixing these unhealthy and costly habits?
We all want better health, and we feel a sense of urgency about it. We need it now.
Our guest today is at the center of efforts to promote better health now by investing in person-centered, accessible, and equitable primary care. Anne Greiner is the CEO of the Primary Care Collaborative.
Invest in what works, and we have this incredible evidence base that primary care is the one part of our healthcare system. If we put more money into it, it will deliver better patient population outcomes and more equity. Pay for what we want. Better health, and also we need to reduce economic and social barriers to better health, because if we don't do that, not all Americans are going to achieve better health.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Anne, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
I have an obligation to say that we have a bias here, but I think our listeners know that we are primary care folks, and this is an important issue to us. But more importantly, it's an important issue for all Americans. The primary care collaborative members include both public and private organizations, and the stat really sticks out. Our country devotes just 5 to 7% of healthcare spending to primary care, considerably less than those other high-income countries with better health outcomes. And can you tell our listeners how did we get here?
Well, I do want to even update the latest stat. We're at 4.6%, so less than 5 cents on a dollar. And I think there are many contributors to how we got here, but one is the Medicare physician fee schedule and what it values. And many other payers kind of take off on that fee schedule. And we're not valuing things that are more of the cognitive services, valuing advice that primary care clinicians give related to managing multiple chronic conditions, care integration and care coordination. Those are things that are not valued. While we pay a lot more for surgical interventions and drugs and many other things, but not so much on things that help keep us well or restore us quickly to health when we get sick.
Well, Anne, we know that primary care through an abundance of research consistently delivers better outcomes and reduces disparities. And that was highlighted, of course, in the report from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. But one of the things we see, and this was just confirmed with yet another national study, is compensation for primary care physicians in particular, probably for everybody on the primary care team, but particularly for physicians, is lagging behind their specialist colleagues in medicine. But I think the question is raising salaries for primary care physicians enough to fix the issue of what a small percentage of physicians are actually choosing primary care? Or are there a host of other critical factors, in your opinion?
Well, that is an important issue, because I think when people come to make a decision about what specialty they're going to pursue and they have a lot of medical debt, you know, it gives them pause to pursue primary care. And that's unfortunate, because it's exactly what we need in our healthcare system. But there are many, many other factors. Primary care is not properly resourced beyond the salaries to actually provide what patients need in terms of more comprehensive care. We know that we have a mental health crisis, for example, but we don't have a financing system that supports the integration of mental health into primary care, which is what patients want. Or we don't have the ability to address substance use disorder, which is also something that many Americans are struggling with. We do not have the ability to really have the sort of comprehensive team that can help patients handle diabetes and hypertension and congestive heart failure. Many things that accompany those chronic conditions require patients to change what they eat and how they exercise. And a more comprehensive team could actually help patients do better. But that's not what our current financing allows for. So I think that there are a host of reasons that contribute to the lack of investment in primary care and are problematic beyond what we pay in terms of physician salaries.
And let me just say that I think that's such a good, such an important point about team-based care. Obviously, we're from the community health center movement, where that is a focus of the work that we do. It's so important. And we've also want to find out what brings people joy in terms of the work that they do. And what we found is that nurse practitioners are an area that we've been really focusing on the development. But before we get to talking about sort of how all of this is organized, I want to really get back to the heart of the dilemma that you face. And maybe an example of when Medicare boosted payments to doctors who evaluate and manage patients and cut payments to those who focus on procedures, those doctors getting less money put up a fight. You have a very diverse coalition, but not groups like the American College of Surgeons and the hospitals. How do you cross the finish line in this very intense environment with the group that you've organized?
Well, we just as we are advocating for a team to provide a comprehensive set of services, we also do, quote unquote, team-based advocacy for primary care. And we partner with other folks like insurance companies and employers and consumer groups and other stakeholders that also want better health and are very focused on that. And that allows us to move policies forward. For example, we have proposed to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services a new payment model for primary care within the Medicare Accountable Care Organization, the MSSP program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we brought 30 organizations together, and they were very diverse and said, please, we want a new way to pay primary care, and we want to invest more through this alternative payment model within the ACO program. They took notice when 30 different organizations came and put a proposal on the table, and we're hopeful that that model gets introduced this year. So that's how we work. We look to partner with other stakeholders that share the sense that in order to improve the nation's health, we have to pay more attention and spend more on prevention and wellness.
Well, Anne, I understand you also are an advocate of hybrid payment methods with a mix of prospective and fee-for-service payment. I'd love to have you share your thoughts on how this solves issues potentially, and also maybe distinguish between the difference between a prospective reliable payment and the value-based rewards or shared savings that may come or may not come at the end of a year. I think there's a lot of confusion out there beyond the healthcare circles of what we're talking about when we talk about these things.
Yeah. Well, Margaret, thanks so much for that question. And, you know, when I came to the Primary Care Collaborative, I came from the quality movement, and I was excited about the patient-centered medical home and what it promised. But I've turned into someone who's really focused on payment because I don't think that we can adequately achieve those new models of care unless we fix payment. So back to payment. You know, I think that the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, which you mentioned previously, gave us a set of incredible recommendations in five different domains, and one of them is payment. Mm-hmm. And when we had a meeting shortly after the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine published their report and found that, you know, this notion of hybrid payment was something that experts and stakeholders across the spectrum supported, we decided that we would make that a blueprint for our work. And hybrid payment is a mix of fee-for-service and prospective payment or capitation. And it's a mix because, no payment system is perfect, and there are benefits and challenges with each. And so the notion of hybrid is to kind of balance those out. And for example, with fee-for-service, to pay for things that you want to make sure happen, and that might not be done by all practitioners. The capitated payment is for, it could be 40 to 70% perhaps of your payment comes in a monthly payment that you can anticipate and you manage against for your patient population. And it allows the primary care clinician to be much more flexible in how they deliver care, and to either expand or, contract in terms of the amount of care, depending upon what the patient needs. So rather than, being tied to a visit, you have this monthly payment that would come in and you manage against. So it is, on the surface might seem a little bit complicated, but we've seen examples of how this works well. And we put a lot of stock in the evidence that the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine brought together and in their recommendations.
You know, when I think about payment, I think about investment. And there's no greater advocate for investment than the bipartisan Senate bill, the $26 billion bipartisan legislation that would boost our primary care, increase training opportunities for doctors and nurses and other providers, and expand access to community health centers. I know you've been tracking that bill. What are your thoughts about it? And will it see the light of day or parts of it?
Well, I think we're all waiting to see what's going to happen. As we were on had a meeting this morning with folks on the Senate side, and they reminded us that it's hard for them to think about the year ahead because last year's business is not yet done.
Right.
And that's obviously part of last year's business. And we're all anxious and hopeful that this gets over the goal line by March 8th. I think that bill is very important, and it certainly addresses a number of issues, as you said, funding for community health centers and also for training, very important. And Congress's job, I would assert, is not done after, and hopefully that bill gets over the goal line, because, community health centers serve a very important part of the population, 1 in 11, and some of the most vulnerable. There's other things that Congress needs to focus on in terms of primary care for the other 10 and 11. And so we're hopeful, and we are having numerous conversations that Congress will also begin to turn their lens and open the aperture to look at primary care more broadly, lift up CHCs, and think about primary care more broadly so that we can advance the health of all Americans.
Well, Anne, in your advocacy, you often refer to the patient-centered medical home, a term that I think has probably been around long enough that most of our audience understands what it means. But I wonder if you could define it for us, and also how it fits into your mission. I think I might just add a third to that. This is one of those things that really has found resonance in the private practice community, in veteran affairs, the Joint Commission, community health centers. When you see that kind of widespread adoption, that usually says something. But do you think it's made a difference? Has it helped us get back to that ideal of the truly patient-centered health home or medical home for patients?
I think that it has, and I know it's really helped to orient primary care practices to focus on providing care, thinking more in a population basis. So, proactively understanding who's in your population in terms of who has diabetes or asthma or congestive heart failure, and proactively reaching out to make sure that they're getting the services they need, providing really good access, using technology to support care. And I know that in the community health center movement, there's been really fantastic adoption of the patient-centered medical home. And as you said, in the VA, the commercial sector to some extent, but I think the financing model has not supported the full blown patient-centered medical home as we had hoped for in the private sector. And so this is where we need payment reform to be able to support the patient-centered medical home and other models of advanced primary care, which I would assert are really, you know, cousins and mothers and fathers of the patient-centered medical home. They're variants, but it's all very much in line with a more population-based approach using technology, much better access, and it doesn't need to be a physical home. Let's just be clear on that. I think we can take good advantage of virtual visits, patient portals, all kinds of ways to have touches with your patient that supports them in their care journey, and also provides them a home where your data is in one place, where you can get the integration and coordination across different conditions that you might have.
Well, if we couldn't agree with you more about the lessons, you know, that we had to learn about the full integration of behavioral health and primary care, and of course, oral health while we're at it in the community health center world, and all lessons that can be adopted by primary care in any system. But, you know, we can't overlook the power of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and their influence, and certainly through billing codes. And you've been touting the importance of a proposed CMS add-on code that is intended to provide patients and their primary care providers more time together to manage complex conditions. Where do things stand on this front? What was the origin of this? And are you optimistic about seeing that come to fruition? Sounds like a wonderful idea from the point of view of anyone who cares for patients with complex conditions.
Well, it is. And the code is G2211. And it's a very important way that primary care can get, you know, can be resourced for the care that it provides to those who have very complex needs. So I think it is really important. The final rule came out at the end of the year. There has been efforts to try to overturn it. And I think those continue. We are hopeful that those will not be successful, frankly. And we'll know, you know, in the end of you know, the package when it emerges. But I think there's growing recognition that our healthcare system is not doing a good job taking care of patients with complex needs. We see that in our life expectancy data and in our understanding of the number of chronic conditions we see expanding in terms of that Americans are facing. And so, we have a system that I think does not support that. You know, integration and coordination. And so patients are left kind of being their own general contractors, going to this specialist and that specialist, and themselves trying to figure out how to integrate and coordinate the various advice they're receiving. They really want a partner to help them. It's complicated. And we have a very chaotic healthcare system. And so what I think we need to do is really strengthen that foundation so that primary care can support patients in this journey, which is often, fairly challenging, particularly if you have 2, 3 or more chronic conditions. And unfortunately, more Americans are in that situation.
And speaking of situations Americans are in, and you talked earlier about virtual homes, health homes, and with the mental health crisis, we're seeing larger uptick of the use of telehealth. I know that was one of the sort of silver linings, if you will, during the pandemic. It allowed people to really explore an area that had really been limited. But, you know, there are some fixes that need to be made, and you're calling on Medicare to remove its initial in-person requirement necessary to trigger payments for telemental health services. And can you explain what the holdup is? And it seems like a very practical solution. I will certainly say for so many working families who are working hourly, the notion that you have to take an hour bus ride to get to a place, to wait a half an hour to be seen for 15 minutes and then repeat it, sort of suggests that people aren't really listening or understanding the practical reality that so many people face.
Yeah, I think it might, its origins might be really around this notion of you really need to establish first a relationship in person. You know, and I think these last number of years have demonstrated to us that you can establish relationships over Zoom. You know, given the shortage of mental health professionals, and also, as you pointed out, you know, how time intensive it is to, you know, travel places, particularly if you're in a rural community, mm-hmm. Or you don't have access to transportation to get, you know, wherever you need to go to have that visit. We just think that we can be more flexible you know, move that forward. Interestingly, we had conversations with some leading consumer groups, they evolved their position in conversation with us. So we're appreciative of that and hopeful that this, you know, this policy will evolve.
Well, Anne, I'm going to get into the weeds a little bit more about the kind of system in which you get your care and what difference does it make. So there's some evidence, I think, that shows that accountable care organizations can be helpful in terms of improving care and being attendant to the cost issues. There is some further evidence that when those ACOs are led by clinicians, I think most of them have studied physicians in leadership, that you may do better than in organizations that are not led by the clinical experts. And then there's maybe more newsworthy stories than I've seen in the peer-reviewed literature about what's the impact of who owns the whole health system. If you look at venture-influenced health systems. And some of this we're reading in the academic literature, but mostly we're reading that, I would say, in the news. What are you doing in your organization around looking at this influence on cost and outcomes and the patient-centeredness of who owns the operation? And what's its primary focus? Is it primary care or is it healthcare writ large? You want to try and tackle that one? I know it's a long question.
Well, I do think governance is really important. And I think that that's something to understand. Who is making the decisions, you know, that affect the clinical enterprise? And, you know, are those being made by clinicians? And are they shaping them, or are those business decisions? And I think that's a real question, because as a patient, I really want, you know, clinicians to have a lot of influence over those set of decisions. So, you know, whatever the financing is, I think the governance is really important to look at. I do think that the data that we have from MSSP, which is the Medicare ACO, is really quite interesting. Mm-hmm. That those that are primary care centric are achieving twice the savings of those that are not. And I think what it begins to raise for us is, you know, well, why is that? I do think, you know, it's part of the governance, as I mentioned earlier, but also the alignment of incentives. You know, yeah. If you have an incentive system that is thinking not only about prevention, but also has at the same time has to think about, you know, are all of our beds filled? Those are, you know, two different incentive systems, and, you know, they may be canceling each other out, you know, with some of the hospital-led ACOs. Now, there are hospitals that are really population-focused and are committed to primary care and have a different approach. But I think these are all trends that we're watching and trying to understand. And there's, you know, there's a lot going on, and disentangling what's happening is a complex business. But when we can point to the data, I think we really and see that over time. It's not just 1 year. I think we really need to pay attention to that.
Well, I think it's such a good point. I'm wondering if there's any scorecard. I'm sitting here as a consumer, seeing lots of mergers going on with hospitals. Seems like it's a sucking sound of taking away primary care dollars ultimately. Across the board, because there's just a large health industrial complex here that doesn't seem to be slowing down. That's a pretty big fight that you've got on your hands. And how are you able to educate the average citizen about this? And I know you're focused in on the policy and doing such a great job, but what are some guideposts for simple consumer out there trying to figure out these large mergers? And what does it mean for me?
Yeah. Well, the economists will tell you that when you have consolidation of hospitals in a market, that prices go up. So that's not great for consumers. You know, that when you have I think that is problematic. You know, what happens for consumers when primary care is now a part of a hospital system? You know, I think that's an open question, and you need to kind of examine that. Do I still have the same amount of time with my primary care clinician as I once had? Where are they referring me in terms of, you know, specialty services or acute care services? Is it within that hospital network, or do they consider, you know, other specialists or other hospitals that might be able to meet my needs? So as a patient, you might ask those kinds of questions. So, you know, I think the administration is also examining these kinds of issues around consolidation and competition. Do we have less competition? And so that means with consolidation, then that means prices are going to go up, and that's not good for consumers. These are all, you know, very important questions for us to be watching, but not to just watch forever. If we see in markets that consolidation is not turning out to be good for consumers, then, you know, I think the regulators and others should be concerned and take action.
Ann Greiner, CEO of the Primary Care Collaborative, we want to thank you for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare. And thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program with us. Ann, thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm a big fan of your program.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.